Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the March 27, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we see Donald Trump in the foreground. He's got his back to us. He's looking out over the, I guess it's the Straits of Hormuz. He's got his face turned to the side. He looks angry, and he's got his left fist balled up. Out in the middle of the water, we see an oil tanker on fire, kind of listing in the water. The skies are dark with smoke. The headline is Dire Straits. Does Trump have a plan to break Iran's oil blockade? That is our first main story. We'll start right there. Trump weighs putting boots on the ground in Iran. What happened? President Trump lashed out at U.S. allies this week after they rebuffed his demand to help break Iran's blockade of a crucial oil shipping route. As the energy shock unleashed by the U.S.-Israel war with the Islamic Republic reverberated around the globe, traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf Channel that carries 20% of the world's oil, has slowed to a trickle since the war started on February 28th, causing the cost of crude to spike more than 50% to above $110 a barrel. Few shipping companies want to risk a voyage through the channel. Iran has hit at least 16 ships with drones and missiles, and according to U.S. officials, has begun laying mines in the strait. Trump demanded that European nations, China, Japan, South Korea, and other countries that receive oil from the Middle East send warships to escort tankers, warning that if NATO allies don't step up, it would be very bad for the future. No nation offered ships. This is not our war, said German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius. Trump then raged on Truth Social that the U.S. did not need the help of anyone to open the strait. We never did. Israel intensified its strikes on the Iranian regime, killing Intelligence Minister Esmail Khatib and top security official Ali Larijani, the country's de facto ruler. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the crushing strikes had created optimal conditions for an uprising. Trump said asking unarmed Iranian civilians to take on a regime that killed up to 30,000 protesters in January was a big hurdle to climb. Officials in Tehran said more than 1,300 Iranian civilians had been killed in the war so far. At least 13 U.S. personnel have died, including six crew members on board a refueling plane that crashed in Iraq last week. U.S. National Counterterrorism Center Director Joe Kent announced his resignation, saying he couldn't support the war in good conscience and that U.S. soldiers shouldn't die in a conflict started due to pressure from Israel. The departure of Kent, an outspoken member of the America First movement, came as warships carrying 2,500 Marines headed from Asia to the Persian Gulf, fueling speculation they could be used to seize the Strait of Karg Island, or Karg Island, a departure point for Iran's oil exports. Asked if he was worried that deploying ground troops might lead to a quagmire, Trump said, "I'm not really afraid of anything." What the columnist said. Trump's catastrophic war is the worst conceived in American history, said Jen Rubin in The Contrarian. He was warned that a U.S. attack would lead Iran to close the Strait of Hormuz and that attempting to topple an entrenched regime was fraught with risk. But pumped up by the lightning capture of Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro, he ignored the red flags. Now the war is raging out of control. The price of gas, diesel, and jet fuel is spiking, and the economy is teetering. Iran's closure of the strait isn't just a blow to the global economy, said Rich Lowry in National Review. It's an assault against one of the foundations of American power. Allowing it to stand would bring intolerable economic damage and our national humiliation. Trump has two options. Negotiate a ceasefire with an enemy that's just demonstrated de facto control of one of the most consequential waterways in the world, or break their grip on the strait by force of arms. That won't be easy, said Sarah Young and John Irish in Reuters. The strait's shipping lanes, which are just 2 nautical miles wide, wind past a mountainous coast that provides cover for Iranian forces. While Iran's navy has been obliterated, the elite Revolutionary Guard still has plenty of ways to attack, including speedy small boats, mines, and anti-ship missiles. Getting a few ships a day through the U.S. Navy escorts would be feasible in the short term, but hard to sustain in the long run. 3 weeks into the war, Trump is staring down a stalemate, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. U.S. and Israeli strikes have laid waste to the Iranian regime's military and political infrastructure, but they haven't broken the mullah's will. As they choke energy shipping and keep hitting our Gulf allies, Trump faces a fateful choice, to pull back or dive in deeper. If he retreats without reopening the strait or securing Iran's nuclear materials, the words, "Trump always chickens out," will be carved on his tombstone. But to plunge further into the chaos of an escalating and widening war is loaded with other risks. Netanyahu has his own goals, said Adam Razgan in the New York Times. He's betting that Israel's attacks on Iranian security forces will destabilize a widely hated regime and pave the way for a popular uprising. "I'm telling the Iranian people," he said this week, "the moment you can come out for freedom is getting closer." U.S. intelligence agencies don't think that's likely, said Ellen Nakashima in the Washington Post. In their assessment, the regime will remain intact and possibly even emboldened by the war, believing it stood up to Trump and survived. As a military campaign that was supposed to be quick, surgical operation deepens, Trump's White House allies increasingly fear the off-ramps are closing, said Megan Messerly in Politico. They see Trump being boxed into a corner where escalation and putting boots on the ground becomes the only way to credibly claim victory. Given the steep cost of walking away, fear is growing that Trump is drifting toward the kind of open-ended Middle East conflict he has long railed against. Controversy of the week, Iran. Is the U.S. ready for a new wave of terrorism? As President Trump boasts about the pain he's inflicting on Iran, Americans are discovering violence has a way of breaking containment, said Campbell Robertson and Tim Arango in the New York Times. On March 1st, the war's second day, a gunman wearing a T-shirt with Iranian flag colors opened fire outside a bar in Austin, killing 3 people and wounding 15. A week later, 2 ISIS-supporting teenagers from Pennsylvania tried to explode homemade bombs at a protest in New York City. And in the space of 2 hours last week, an ISIS supporter fatally shot an ROTC instructor at Old Dominion University in Virginia, and a Lebanese-American man rammed an explosive-laden truck into a synagogue in West Bloomsfield Township, Michigan, where 140 children were attending preschool. The attacker, Ayman Mohammed Ghazali, was killed by security. His was the only death. There's no evidence Iran directed any of these attacks, but faced with an existential threat, the regime in Tehran might activate sleeper cells and conduct assassinations, bombings, and cyber strikes in the U.S. The violence in the Middle East could also inspire more attacks by lone offenders like Ghazali, who went on the rampage after an Israeli airstrike on Hezbollah targets in Lebanon killed four members of his family. Team Trump may be less ready to deal with such threats than previous administrations, said Daniela Czeslaw in Politico. It's not just that the Department of Homeland Security is partially shut down, with Democrats refusing to fund the department unless there are meaningful immigration enforcement reforms. It's also that former DHS Secretary Kristi Noem slashed the staff at an intelligence office that would ordinarily focus on the kind of threats posed by Iran. Meanwhile, the National Counterterrorism Center, which fuses intelligence about threats from across the government, has shifted its focus under Trump toward drug cartels. And then there's Kash Patel, said former FBI agents Jacqueline McGuire in the New York Times. The sophomoric FBI director has redirected counterterrorism personnel to work on Trump's migrant crackdown and purge scores of agents, including a dozen Iran specialists just days before the war. Their crime? Taking part in past investigations of Trump. The deeper problem is that terrorism has evolved, said Kevin Cohen in the Wall Street Journal. In the years after 9/11, security agencies focused on keeping foreign radicals from either entering the country or recruiting people already here. But in 2026, most terrorists are made in the USA, like last week's attackers. U.S.-born or naturalized citizens who self-radicalize and are near impossible to identify before they act. Not everything has changed, said the Free Press in an editorial. We don't help ourselves by ignoring the truth that these terrorists share the same Islamist ideology that motivated the 9/11 hijackers. A society they cannot name its enemies cannot protect itself against them. If demonizing Muslims were enough to keep us safe, Trump might be the perfect leader for this moment, said Jackie Calms in the Los Angeles Times. But it isn't, and he isn't. The same recklessness that led Trump to launch a war with no clear goal or exit plan has left us effectively undefended from retaliatory attacks. Our security agencies have been gutted. The professionals who ran them have been replaced with genuflecting enablers. And they answer to a president who, when asked last week if he expected Iran-related terrorism on U.S. soil, could only reply with a shrug. I guess. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It's a good week for traction. After the Big 12 basketball tournament abandoned its new LED glass court mid-competition and reverted to a hardwood, following numerous player complaints about the slippery surface. It was like a rug being pulled under me, said BYU forward Mihailo Boskovic. It was a good week for self-esteem after First Lady Melania Trump told the crowd at a White House Women's History Month event, "As a visionary, I know success is not born overnight." The self-described humanitarian, philanthropist, and entrepreneur said her achievements stemmed from her ability to follow my passion and always maintain a laser focus. It's a good week for upsets after Venezuela beat Team USA 3-2 to win the World Baseball Classic, less than 3 months after the U.S. captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Delcy Rodriguez, Maduro's Trump-approved replacement, declared a national day of jubilation to celebrate the win. It was a bad week for merit after Olympic bobsled bronze medalist Callie Humphreys presented President Trump with the Order of ECOS, a medallion Team USA medal-winning athletes typically bestow on coaches, parents, or other supportive figures. Wow, I knew I liked her, gushed Trump. It was a bad week for rock and roll after singer Morrissey canceled a concert in Spain, blaming a noisy hotel and resulting sleep deprivation. The former Smiths frontman, who has spent decades exploring themes of self-pity and despair, characterized his hotel experience as indescribable hell, adding, "It will take me 1 year to recover, And that is an understatement. Finally, it was a bad week for the spirit of William F. Buckley, Jr. After former Fox News host Megyn Kelly, who opposes the war in Iran, accused current Fox host Mark Levin of having a micropenis, which prompted Levin, a war supporter, to call Kelly a harlot. Time for the briefing. Title this week, The Weed Killer Wars. Trump wants the U.S. to ramp up production of glyphosate. The MAHA movement is furious. What is glyphosate? It's the world's most used herbicide, best known in the U.S. as Roundup. American farmers alone spray about 300 million pounds of it on fields annually. Such chemical herbicides have long been opposed by environmental groups and Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s MAGA-aligned Make America Healthy Again movement, which claims glyphosate causes cancer and other health problems. Bayer, the German chemicals giant that makes Roundup, last month proposed a $7.25 billion settlement to resolve tens of thousands of lawsuits from people who allege the glyphosate-based weed killer is to blame for their non-Hodgkin lymphoma, a cancer of the immune system. Bayer insists glyphosate is safe and has not admitted liability, but in 2023 began phasing the chemical out of Roundup sold for residential use. So, MAHA activists were stunned when President Trump issued an executive order a day after the settlement was announced to boost glyphosate production, calling it central to American economic and national security. Zen Honeycutt, founder of the MAHA-linked Moms Across America group, said she felt sick to my stomach when she read the executive order, calling it a love letter to glyphosate. Is glyphosate safe? The evidence is mixed. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, an affiliate of the World Health Organization, designated the herbicide in 2015 as probably carcinogenic to humans. Bayer points out that the IARC puts drinking hot beverages and eating red meat at the same hazard level as glyphosate, and that other public health bodies, including the EPA and the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, disagree with this assessment. But Leanne Shepherd, a University of Washington professor who served on the EPA panel that reviewed glyphosate in 2016, notes that scientific evidence for the herbicide's effects on human health has recently strengthened for cancer and other endpoints. What is that evidence? A meta-study she co-authored found that people with high exposures, such as agricultural workers or people who live near farms, have a 41% increased risk of developing non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Meanwhile, laboratory studies using human cells and animals suggest glyphosate can damage DNA and harm the liver and kidneys. Critics caution that animal and cell studies typically use far higher exposure levels than most people would encounter. There's just no compelling evidence that glyphosate causes cancer, said Robert Tarone, a 28-year veteran of the National Cancer Institute. But other scientists argued that there's a lack of hard evidence showing glyphosate to be safe, especially following the retraction in November of a landmark study cited by many regulators as proof that the herbicide is not carcinogenic. Why was that study pulled? Because lawsuits against Monsanto, the former owner of Roundup, which Bayer acquired for $63 billion in 2018, revealed emails that show the company's scientists secretly helped conceive and write the supposedly independent study. In messages sent in 2000, one Monsanto employee complimented her colleague's hard work on the paper and said the plan is now to utilize it both in the defense of Roundup and Roundup Ready crops worldwide. In withdrawing the study, the Regulatory Toxicology and Pharmacology Journal cited serious ethical concerns over the independence and accountability of the authors, who may have been paid by Monsanto for their work. The study's retraction doesn't mean its findings were incorrect, but it adds to the haze of uncertainty around glyphosate. We absolutely must study it, given it is the most commonly used herbicide in the world, said Brenda Eskenazi, a public health expert at the University of California, Berkeley. Even a small, tiny effect, if it's real, can have a huge public health impact because so many people would be exposed. How many people are exposed to the herbicide? A 2024 CDC study found glyphosate traces in the urine of about 70 to 80% of Americans. But researchers say that the presence of the chemical does not mean it is causing harm. While running for president in 2024, Kennedy vowed to curb Americans' exposure to glyphosate, which he called one of the likely culprits in America's chronic disease epidemic. And as an environmental lawyer in 2018, Kennedy won a nearly $290 million lawsuit against Monsanto, in which he argued Roundup caused his school groundskeeper client to develop cancer. But since joining the agribusiness-friendly Trump administration, Kennedy has quieted his criticisms. What has he said about glyphosate? The first report from the White House's Kennedy-led MAHA Commission in May mentioned glyphosate once in 72 pages, saying studies have noted a range of possible health effects. A second 20-page report in September made no mention of that. That led to rumblings of discontent in the MAHA movement, which became thunderous after Trump's executive order. In a statement, Kennedy said herbicides are toxic by design, but that he backed the president's order as a necessary step to bring agricultural chemical production back to the United States. Many MAHA supporters, a group that includes 62% of parents who identify as Republican, called that about-face a betrayal. So-called MAHA moms feel like they were lied to, said conservative wellness influencer Alex Clark. How am I supposed to rally these women to vote red in the midterms? Kelly Ryerson, a MAHA advocate who goes by Glyphosate Girl online, said the order feels very, very much like the breaking point. People can't continue to make excuses for the administration. And a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Putin's big windfall from the Iran war. Who's the real winner so far of the war in Iran? Asked Michael McFaul. Russian dictator Vladimir Putin. With the Strait of Hormuz closed, global oil prices have soared to more than $100 a barrel, earning Russia an additional $150 million a day in exports. To free up supplies, Trump also eased sanctions on Russian oil, providing Moscow with additional billions in revenue. This will mean more money for Putin to build more weapons to kill more Ukrainians and boost Russia's struggling economy. To defend against Iranian missiles and drones, the U.S. also has fired more than 1,000 Patriot missile interceptors, more than Washington has supplied to Kyiv during the entire 4 years of the Russian war against Ukraine. That likely means the U.S. will no longer sell those interceptors to Europe for Ukraine's defense. Even as he benefits from Trump's war, Putin has directed his intelligence services to give Iran targeting information so it can better hit U.S. bases and kill Americans. As usual, Trump sounded like Putin's patsy in downplaying this hostile action, saying he may be helping them a bit, yeah. By choosing war in Iran, Trump is helping Putin more than a bit. Our economy depends on immigrants. America badly needs immigrants, said George F. Will. Former President Joe Biden's choice not to enforce immigration laws led to about 8 million migrants entering the country, mostly through asylum applications, and poisoned the debate. But President Trump's mass deportation program is an overcorrection that's damaging the economy and costing the U.S. Treasury billions. The U.S.'s birth rate is below replacement levels, and the population is aging. Immigration provides workers we desperately need. Foreign-born workers account for 15.9% of nurses, 28.4% of health aides, and 23.6% of STEM jobs. Immigrant workers, including those without legal status, pay taxes that help fund Social Security and Medicare, upon which many older Americans rely. Between 1994 and 2023, a recent Cato Institute report found the foreign-born population generated more in taxes than they received in benefits from all levels of government, providing a fiscal surplus of $14.5 trillion. Immigration is by nature an entrepreneurial act, and recent arrivals provide a disproportionately high portion of startup businesses and patents. Millions of immigrants have been here for decades, raised children born on U.S. soil, and their labor helps make this country function. Talk of sending them home is nonsensical. They are home. This column comes from Germany. Hollywood preens as the world burns. Hollywood elites are pretending that U.S. democracy is not collapsing around them, said Mark Pitsky. The self-delusion is painful to witness. At the Oscars, a ceremony usually as rife with political speeches as it is with glam and glitz, there was little sense that the U.S. is currently embroiled in a war that is shaking the global order to its core. Little appreciation for the reality that American elections will soon be effectively a farce. It's not as if the stars were oblivious to what's going on. They couldn't be. What with anti-terrorist units patrolling the sun-drenched sidewalks outside the Dolby Theater and snipers lurking on rooftops, the actors and film workers receiving their industry awards each had a microphone, each stood before a global audience. They could have spoken out against their mad president's insane war, which is threatening the peace and prosperity of the whole world, or even more selfishly, against his assault on freedoms for Americans. Only a few did, and only in offhand comments. Javier Bardem said, "No to war and free Palestine," while Jimmy Kimmel made a joke about freedom of speech. Only after the ceremony did filmmaker David Borenstein get explicit, quoting a Russian colleague who said that the authoritarian takeover was happening even faster in the U.S. than it had in Russia. These Oscars were the best proof of that. Time for the last word, our feature article. California's deadliest avalanche. During a dangerous blizzard, 15 skiers took a risky backcountry route near Lake Tahoe, said Joshua Partlow in The Atlantic. It would prove to be a fatal mistake. On the morning of the deadliest avalanche in California's modern history, Cody Townsend was skiing above the west shore of Lake Tahoe. People like him, who live for untracked expanses of wilderness snow, had found little to celebrate this season. Across much of the American West, the temperatures had been high, and the hills here bare and brown. According to the Central Sierra Snow Lab, operating from a cabin nearby, accumulation had been running 7 feet below normal. But now snow was dumping. Dry, light flakes swirled around him, and with every turn, Townsend disappeared into great clouds of powder. It was the storm of the year in the Sierras, he would write that day. Yet something felt off. The wind was picking up. The temperature seemed odd. Townsend is a professional backcountry skier who learned the sport around Tahoe, and it was just the consistency of the snowfall, the way that flakes were coming down, the winds that were coming through, that had just something different, something I wasn't used to, he told me. He and his wife, Elise Sauskad, a professional free skier who had survived a 2012 avalanche that left three others in her group dead, decided to bail. That morning, elsewhere around Lake Tahoe, a group of 15 skiers ventured out into the storm from the Frog Lake backcountry huts, a cluster of coveted off-the-grid cabins where they had stayed for the past 2 nights. The group included several women who were close friends and relatives, accomplished working mothers, many of whom lived in the Bay Area and whose kids attended a Tahoe ski school, and was led by four guides employed by a local company, Blackbird Mountain Guides. The group was there to ski far from chairlifts and groomed runs, to trek uphill, aided by grips on the bottom of skis, and glide down untracked bowls. The huts, set on the lake shore at 7,600 feet amid red fir and Jeffrey pine, opened in 2022 and quickly became regarded as a jewel of the country's network of wilderness cabins. Booking them can cost more than $1,000 for a multi-day trip. Some trips include chefs to prepare meals in the commercial-grade kitchen. When reservations became available, they normally booked within minutes. This group was scheduled to return home that day, and despite the storm, the skiers set off along a route of more than 3 miles that begins with a climb, proceeds through a gap in the mountains, and runs along a forested ridge. They had gone less than a mile when someone shouted, "Avalanche!" A local sheriff's deputy would later report. Then a slab of snow about the length of a football field crashed down onto them, catching all but two of the skiers. Ultimately, only six of the group would survive. 2 weeks after this tragedy, the guides' decisions to ski through the blizzard to travel a risky route remain the mystery at its center as law enforcement and the wider community look for answers. The Nevada County Sheriff's Office and California's Workplace Safety Agency are investigating potential safety violations or criminal negligence by Blackbird. Zeb Blase, the owner of Blackbird, has offered condolences in a statement, but he has not otherwise spoken publicly. His company referred questions to a public relations firm that did not respond to requests for comment. Blase himself has skied and guided in Alaska and Antarctica, Japan and the Himalayas. In a podcast a couple of years ago, while describing how guides monitor avalanche conditions, he allowed that there's just a certain degree of uncertainty that we just can't eliminate. The Frog Lake huts would have been a good place to ride out a storm. The guides and avalanche experts I talked with wonder why the group ventured out in such conditions, but even more so how they chose their path home. The question is, why did they go into the terrain that they went to, Townsend told me. What led them to believe their way out was the correct way that day? It was an obvious mistake. From the beginning of the trip, the Sierra Avalanche Center, a nonprofit that works with the local Forest Service field, had been warning about worsening avalanche danger, including near the Frog Lake huts. On the morning of the slide, the center put the avalanche danger at high, the fourth of five threat levels. Travel in, near, or below avalanche terrain is not recommended today, read the report issued at 6:29 a.m. that day. The usually warm conditions in the weeks before had melted some snow, even at high altitudes. A dry stretch had created a layer of weak, sugary grains, and the incoming storm had buried that in feet of heavy snow. The center's observers had skied out to this area the day before the avalanche and witnessed widespread cracks and areas of unstable snow. On a backcountry trip, ski guides typically meet in the morning and evening to discuss conditions and plan routes. They closely follow these avalanche warnings. They know which parts of their route have avalanche risks and where runout zones exist for sliding snow. On the morning that the group at the Frog Lake Huts was set to leave, the four guides had multiple ways out to choose from, including routes to the southeast that would have avoided exposure to avalanche risk. Dave Miller, a backcountry ski guide and avalanche instructor with 25 years of experience, told me, "Our standard is we don't go in or under avalanche terrain when the level is high," said Miller, who owns International Alpine Guides, which has operated in the Tahoe area for decades. The solar-powered huts do have an internet connection, but it's generally not accessible to guests. When Dustin Weatherford worked there for two winters as the hut's first caretaker, he printed out the avalanche and weather reports for guests each morning. He kept a couple weeks' worth of food in case anyone needed to extend their stay. "We were always, always ready, willing, and welcoming to anybody staying if they weren't feeling safe," he told me. The guides knew that the risks to the group were rising. They nixed part of the morning's plan and told the group they needed to head home, two of the trip survivors told the New York Times. The day of the avalanche, the four guides reportedly met without their clients to choose their route out. Other guides told me that Blackbird had skilled employees and a good reputation for safety. Regardless of conditions, guides often choose the routes. Brennan Legace, a Tahoe ski guide who has led trips to the huts, told me, "Most clients are hiring guides to make those decisions for them. The four on this trip had varying degrees of experience. One of them was certified by the American Mountain Guides Association to guide people on split boards, snowboards that split into skis for trekking uphill. Two others were apprentice ski guides, earlier in a training process that can take years. The last, the only one to survive the day, was an assistant ski guide, one notch below certified in the AMGA accreditation process. Blackbird said in a statement that its senior guides communicate remotely with those leading trips to discuss routes and conditions. A former Blackbird guide who requested anonymity, owing to the sensitivity of the situation, told me that typically senior guides would have participated in a morning meeting with the on-site guides before the groups left the hut. And surely that happened the morning of the avalanche. But exactly how much discussion the guides and leadership had over the routes is unclear. The surviving guide may be the only one who knows why exactly the group chose the route it did. He did not respond to my attempts to reach him. When it left the huts that morning, the group started with a deviation from the typical path. It wrapped around Perry's Peak from the north, rather than passing through Frog Lake Notch, an area with avalanche hazards. It was one of the shorter routes out, the Times reported, the one that would put the skiers closest to their cars, but it still included stretches of avalanche terrain that are marked on the cell phone apps that skiing guys regularly consult, Miller said. The guides would have known their choice carried real risk, especially under the conditions they faced, or they should have known. Snow was piling up that morning at 4 inches an hour, twice the rate that experts view as a threshold for increased avalanche danger. Because those first minutes after an avalanche are so crucial, guides will often consider, too, the added risk of venturing out in storm conditions that would make helicopter access impossible. "You're generally going to take a lot less risk," Miller said, "when the weather is bad, and you're not going to get a quick rescue." The 911 call came in at 11:30 a.m. on February 17th. The Nevada County Sheriff's Office started marshaling dozens of rescuers, many of them volunteers from across multiple counties. They'd be split into two teams and sent via different routes in motorized snowcats, a sort of truck on tracks and on skis. By that time, wind-whipped snow was making it nearly impossible to see, and authorities had closed down Interstate 80, the highway that runs over the mountain pass. Authorities knew from the satellite messages that were coming through that several people had survived the crush. But going in would be dangerous because of the treacherous weather and the risk of another avalanche. The authorities kept extra rescuers on hand in case they faced an incident within an incident, said Lieutenant Dennis Hack, the incident commander throughout the recovery process. To reach the avalanche site, the rescuers fought through whiteout conditions. The snowcats reached the Frog Lake huts, where they had to stop. Beyond that point, the slope got steeper. Only the rescue skiers could get up there. That rescuers were able to reach the area safely suggests to other guides that the backcountry skiers had strayed from a less dangerous path. As to how or why they deviated only slightly, only 50 to 100 yards off that route, and put themselves into that spot, is a big question that I think all of us would like to know, the former Blackbird guide said. When the rescuers found the survivors 6 hours after the initial call, two survivors had injuries, but all six were able to move under their own power back to the huts, where snowcats had parked to drive them out. The nine dead skiers remained on the mountain that night. Over the next days, snow kept falling. One hallmark of our warming climate is the whiplash from periods of extended drought to extreme precipitation. The Central Sierra Snow Lab would record more than 9 feet of snow in 120 hours, the most to accumulate in any five-day period since April 1982, and the third highest total since 1971, according to its director, Andrew Schwartz. For 2 days, the authorities waited for a window in the weather to recover the dead. Eight of the nine had been found in the initial search, and the last missing skier was found days later. They had all been buried within a 20 by 20 foot area near the toe of the avalanche debris, under as much as 8 feet of snow. A lingering question is why the group was clustered together if the guides knew the group was traveling below avalanche terrain. Standard backcountry protocol is to expose only one person at a time if traveling through an avalanche path. When the area was finally safe, helicopters from California Highway Patrol and the California Army National Guard hoisted the dead skiers' bodies from the slope and airlifted them back to the huts, where they were driven out by snowcats. One day after the last of the bodies was recovered, dozens of people in hats and parkas crowded together at a vigil for a moment of silence and to pay their respects. Why do we do this? Why do we put ourselves in harm's way? Kyle Conrad, a bearded backcountry skier, asked as he held a candle. It comes from a place of love and joy. Peter Atkin, whose wife Carrie died in the avalanche, said something similar in a statement. Some of our most precious family memories were built at the Frog Lake huts. Carrie was a leadership coach and mother of two. The family lived in the Tahoe area and had been to the cabins many times. Her husband described the huts as a place where she felt truly at home. The people who live here, who love these mountains, know even small mistakes can be unforgiving, and they know why people take those risks anyway. This was adapted from an article that first appeared in The Atlantic. Pick up one of the business columns today. autos, bad timing for the war on EVs. America is paying the price for sticking with gas, said Tim Levine in The Atlantic. As war in Iran continues to choke the global supply of oil, average gas prices have risen from $2.94 a month ago to $3.63. The nation could have entered this fiasco with a better hand if it had stuck with the pro-electric vehicle path laid out by the Biden administration. But President Trump loathes everything about green energy, and his administration and the Republican-controlled Congress has spent the past year devising new and creative ways to keep the country hooked on internal combustion. Their signature tax bill killed the $7,500 EV tax credit, which halved electric car sales overnight. And with fewer regulations on tailpipe emissions, automakers have seized the opportunity to double down on expensive gas guzzlers. Last week, Honda became the latest car maker to join the trend, axing three upcoming EVs before production even begun. At least some car buyers are paying attention, said David Ferris in Politico. On the car site Edmunds, the percentage of car shoppers looking to buy EVs is up to 22.4% from 20.7% in a week. Whether this is the beginning of a tide that refocuses Americans on hybrid and electric vehicles depends on whether higher gas prices become a difficult new normal for drivers or the current spike is short-lived. Automakers didn't need this headache, said Sharon Turlep and Christopher Ottz in the Wall Street Journal. With Trump's encouragement, American manufacturers like General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis bet on American energy dominance and low fuel costs that were here to stay. The pivot cost them billions in write-downs on EV manufacturing facilities and technologies that were no longer needed. Now investors are starting to wonder whether the U.S. auto industry, with its truck-heavy lineups, can weather this storm if sticker shock starts to put a damper on sales. I'm an EV owner, and going electric isn't a no-brainer yet, said Christopher Mims, also in the Journal. Battery-powered cars have fewer mechanical parts than conventional autos, but they are also laden with technology which can send costs spiking even for minor bumps and scrapes. Not all mechanics are EV certified, which is often required for insurance claims. And while America's highways are now dotted with fast charging stations at regular intervals, road trips still require a lot of stopping and pre-planning, and patients waiting at chargers that still take far longer than the pump. All that aside, I don't regret our decision to get an EV and pity other drivers that still have to stop at gas stations. That's why Honda's timing could not have been worse, said Tim Deschant in TechCrunch. The Japanese automaker reported its first annual loss as a public company since 1957 and used it as an excuse for canceling the development of the electric Acura RDX and the Honda Zero sedan and SUV, three models that were the company's first ground-up EVs. Honda blamed the low-cost and tech-laden EVs coming from China, which has positioned itself perfectly to absorb any oil shock from the Middle East. Other automakers look like they don't have a plan, and they don't have any chance of surviving the current wave of disruption that's sweeping the industry. On the health science page, the fascinating multiplicity of ants. There are at least 20 quadrillion ants of over 20,000 species on Earth. It's a lot to study, and a new project called AntScan just made that process much easier by creating a database of high-resolution 3D images of nearly 2,200 specimens. Using a synchrotron particle accelerator, which generates intense and tunable radiation for imaging atomic structures, scientists in Germany X-ray scanned the bodies. Then they used AI to reposition the images of the dead, somewhat shriveled ants into more natural poses. The scans go to micron scale and are so detailed that they will allow researchers to peer inside the tiny bodies, revealing brains, guts, and glands. With such precise imagery, scientists will be able to make discoveries at a glance that would normally require slicing open individual specimens. The new scans have already revealed, for example, that an armor-like exoskeleton, thought to be unique to one species, is actually found in many more. The diversity is absolutely stunning, biologist Thomas Van de Kamp tells the New York Times, from very huge ones like the bullet ants to super tiny ants, specialist predators of spider eggs. The study authors hope the technique can be expanded beyond ants to document the biology of all living creatures. How stressful people age you. That friend or family member who drives you crazy may be doing more than ruining your mood. They could be causing you to grow old faster. Researchers asked over 2,000 participants in Indiana to identify hasslers, people in their lives who created problems or generally made life more difficult. Then they analyzed the participants' saliva for DNA changes associated with aging. They found that for every additional hassler a person regularly dealt with, the pace of biological aging increased by 1.5%. The effects were especially pronounced for those with two or more hasslers in their social circle. Women and people in poor health were more likely to report having them, as were those who had undergone difficult childhood experiences. Within families, parents and children were more likely to be hasslers than spouses. Although the study doesn't prove cause and effect, co-author Bree Perry of Indiana University advises people to protect themselves where possible. As soon as you recognize that someone is a hassler, she tells the Washington Post, set limits on the efforts you're putting into that relationship. And we'll catch one of the Talking Points articles. Trump, when footwear becomes fealty. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has a pair. So do Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Vice President J.D. Vance reportedly has four. They're Florsheim dress shoes beloved by Donald Trump, said Andrew Egger in the Bulwark, which members of his cabinet are slavishly wearing in the sort of fealty display usually associated with totalitarian regimes. Trump so loves the $145 black shoes, the Wall Street Journal reported last week, that he's gifted them to all the men in his office. Sometimes guessing at sizes, he often gets them wrong. But one female White House aide told the reporter, it's hysterical because everybody's afraid not to wear them. Photos show cabinet members sporting identical shoes, with Rubio in particular clomping around in outrageously large Oxfords that must cause him blisters. The Secretary of State resembles a small child playing dress-up in daddy's shoes, said Miranda Hyde in The Guardian. Serving El Jefe, he and others have learned, requires submitting utterly to his regular humiliations. Forcing underlings to copy your style is a classic dictator trope, said Miles Taylor in Defiance.news. Think of Mao Zedong and the Mao suit. Iraqi strongman Saddam Hussein and the thick black mustache, widely aped by subordinates. The military tunic that under Joseph Stalin became the unofficial costume of every Soviet apparatchik. Wearing his chosen Florsheims is a loyalty test for Trump, and it identifies who can be controlled. There's another subtext in Rubio's oversized clown shoes, said Anna Coppola in Vogue. The Journal reported that Trump asked Vance and Rubio for information before ordering their Florsheim and said, you can tell a lot about a man by his shoe size. Did Rubio, who gave his as 11.5, inflate the number because of the myth that correlates a man's shoe size and his penis length? The Rubio photo tells us where we are at this moment in Trump's second administration, said Tina Brown in her Substack newsletter. Like little Marco, we're trapped in an escapable escape room. in which a wannabe autocrat spouts vehement ignorance, launches wars for fun, and demands that aides, allies, corporations, the press, and foreign adversaries bend their knees to him. It's easy to laugh at the hapless Rubio, but the grim reality is we are all wearing Florsheims now. A couple of short notes. The U.S. homicide rate fell to a 125-year low in 2025, with 4 homicides per 100,000 people, according to projected data from the Nonpartisan Council on Criminal Justice. The Trump administration has made it cheaper for U.S. farmers to hire immigrant laborers on temporary H-2A visas after its policy of immigration raids and mass deportations caused a farm worker shortage. Administration officials said last year that the crackdown would lead to higher wages and a 100% American workforce. Now we'll finish with a couple of quotes. Ulysses S. Grant says, "Any course short of national humiliation or national destruction is better than war." And a quote from Margaret Mead, a famous one, "A small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.